Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, September 26, 2017, starting just after 4 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 125th episode of the show, or actually it's the 126th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Kelly Surtees and Austin Kopic about the astrological forecast for October of 2017. Hey guys, welcome back to the show.
Hey.
Hey Chris, what's up?
Hey, I can't believe it's been a month already since our last forecast. I realize I always say that, but this time it seems like it did go rather fast. So I thought that we would sort of touch on a few things that I've talked about in the podcast this month, just to get you guys' opinion. Talk a little bit about news and events that are happening, and then we'll get straight to the forecast. So in the description, I'll put timestamps. So if anybody wants to skip our initial sort of discussions and go right to the astrological alignments, just look at the description page for this episode and you'll see what point in the recording you can jump to. So Austin is joining us from Oregon, and Kelly, you're traveling at the moment, right?
Yes, I am actually coming to you from Sydney, Australia, where I am visiting family at the moment.
Brilliant. And you lugged your microphone all the way down there.
I did. I know how important the sound is, and I didn't want to sound, you know, I know my Aussie accent it can be a little thicker sometimes when I'm here, so at least we'll hear that clearly.
Sure. Well, I appreciate it. And you're nursing a cold, but you...
Yeah, exactly. So I sound like I don't even know what I sound like right now. I did get a bit of a cold. For the Sydney listeners, they'll know that they've had a very bad cold and flu season here, and landing in the thick of, or the tail end of that, but not having any built-up immunity, I guess. I've got a little bit of a cold.
Well, it sounds fine, so I think we'll be okay. And Austin, are you coming out of the, like, smoke and fire period? Is that cleared up at all in Portland yet? Are you still dealing with that?
Yeah. So I'm about 5 hours south of Portland. It was over 2 weeks straight of just skies full of ash. And it had really just started when we talked last, last month. And, you know, people told me it was normal, but then it kept going and getting worse and worse and worse. Ashland, where I am, actually had the honor of having the worst air quality in the United States for a couple days. You know, it's just skies full of ash, sun looking red through it, you know.
Right.
Half the state on fire.
Right. And that was one of your, like, post-eclipse sort of observations in that part of the country?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, one thing about the eclipse that was interesting was that insofar as it was the Great American Eclipse, the immediate effects were entirely physical and literal. You know, there was some political drama, but that's normal this year, right? It would be strange if there wasn't political drama. But as far as the immediate after effects, it was just literal for the United States. You know, multiple hurricanes, you know, not half, I'm speaking hyperbolically, but an unusual amount of Oregon and California on fire, fire and water. It's a little poetic.
Right. And all of the hurricanes. And then, of course, we're thinking of, you know, a lot of the people in Puerto Rico at this point. A lot of people have lost homes and stuff in Texas and Florida. And then, of course, I just did a webinar, and we had a few.
Oh, and the Mexican earthquakes too.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that in Mexico City and around Mexico, we had a friend, Victor, from Mexico, attended a zodiac releasing workshop I did last weekend, and he's right there in the heart of it. So definitely our thoughts go out to everyone there as well. All right, so I think there's a few preliminary things we needed to get out of the way before we fully jump into the forecast and some of the other discussions. Kelly, you just finished a major project, right?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, the joys of publishing, I finished it in May, but it's finally on sale,
nice.
Which is the Wellbeing Astrology Guide. So it is, Austin's laughing because he's published as well. He knows how it works. It is published out of Australia. It's kind of like a keepsake, we say. It's called a bookazine, so it's pretty high quality. You know, it's not on cheap paper, etc. It does have annual horoscopes in it, but in addition to that, it has a bunch of articles on a variety of topics, all astrological. And it's a mix. Some of it's a bit more modern, some of it's a bit more traditional. So yeah, that's out. I've worked on it every year for the last 13 years, maybe. So it's a great project to do. This year we've got Lynn Bell contributed an article. Who else are our contributors this year? I think we had Astro Sparkles, who's a very popular Facebook astrologer, for people who might know her. Mari Garcia, Andy Gertz, Wade Caves, Sean, Frank, and a bunch of other people. So yeah. Wow.
That's a lot of people. That's like more than almost as much as a Mountain Astrologer, you know, magazine or something.
It's comparable. Like if the Mountain Astrologer did an annual edition, that would be what it's like. So you can buy a hard copy from the publisher in Australia if you're looking to do that, or you can buy an e-version because it's available digitally through Zinio. So they are the international distributor of the e-version. But if anybody wants info, just contact me and I can give them the right links.
Awesome. And I'll put a link to those. I'll get those links from you and put it in the description page for this episode. And then we're actually you've graciously donated two copies that we're going to give away to, in a raffle to two lucky patrons. So I will put out some information about that through Patreon shortly. And in the next week or two, announce the winners of that giveaway. So last month, I actually gave away three copies of Ben Dykes's translation of Theophilus of Edessa, to three lucky patrons. And I just sent those off in the past week. So people should be receiving them shortly. And yeah, so we'll give away a couple of copies of Kelly's magazine here in the next week as well. So Austin, do you have any like things coming up in terms of news and events before we jump into other stuff?
Oh, let's see. I'm pretty midstream on things right now. I'm doing that zodiacal releasing class. We're about halfway through. That's fun. And then I'm actually starting a fundamentals class on synodic cycles, but that starts on the 30th. So this might not be out until like the day before or the day after. So I don't know if people hear it, I guess the live audience, if you want to do synodic cycles and look at planetary appearance and disappearance and retrograde motion and forward motion and visibility and invisibility and Eastern visibility versus Western visibility, et cetera, we're going to do that for a month. That starts this Saturday, September 30th. And then everything else, I'm just sort of in the middle. I think I've got some old classes that finally got edited, so the sound's cleaned up. And I think I'm going to put some of those on sale at some point in October, but I don't know when.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'm sure people can find those on your website at austincopic.com. And Kelly's website, of course, is kellysastrology.com. As for myself and for the podcast, Austin mentioning the audience actually reminds me that so today we have a live audience of people joining us who are patrons of the show who support us through our page on Patreon. And from now on, that's going to be a regular benefit that's available to people on the $3 tier on Patreon and above. So if you'd like to join us for the live recording of the next forecast episode using our live webinar format, then all you have to do is become a patron on the $3 tier, and then you can join us and take place in the discussion that's happening as the episode is taking place, which is not that lively right now, but might pick up a little bit later once we get into the actual forecast. Aside from that, I'm also starting a new sort of private podcast for patrons. It's going to be called the Casual Astrology Podcast, which is basically a monthly show where I just talk about things that I'm researching and little things that were interesting topics that didn't quite make it into a full episode of the astrology podcast. I'm going to take some of those little pieces and turn them into like a 45 minute or hour long episode as a benefit for people on the $10 tier on Patreon, in addition to some other audio sort of snippets and things like that that didn't make it into the full podcast. So again, if you want to sign up for that, just go to our page on Patreon and you can find out more information. All right. So with that out of the way, before we get to the forecast episode, there was a couple of, you know, topics that we touched on this month. One of the ones that people were the most excited about, and then I saw, you know, a few people asking what Austin and Kelly thought about it, is the first episode I did where I did an interview with Moses Sirigar about relocational astrology. And we talked about that topic. It's something that he specialized in. I gave a couple of anecdotes about how relocational astrology has worked in my own life. But I was actually curious if you guys had any experience with that, and if it's something that you use much, or if you put much stock in locational astrology.
Austin, do you want to go first?
Sure. I probably have the least to say. Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at my lines on the free Astrodeans mm-hmm. thing for 15 years. And, you know, boy, I wish I'd listened to your talk with Moses. But what I've found is that the lines make sense, but they're not enough by themselves to make a judgment. If I remember correctly from talking with Moses in the past, he also does like a relocated ascendant for the chart. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. But like my impression of the lines was that there was absolutely something there. But if I were to have made decisions based on the lines alone, I would still be living just south of Cleveland. And where I grew up, and I'm very glad that I'm not living there. No offense to the people who decided to stay in Ohio. It was not sure. for me. I've got like a sweet Jupiter line there, whereas the West Coast, which I've bounced up and down for the last 10 years, and which I really like as far as regions in the United States, is just like Mars Saturn-y doom. But it isn't, my experience of living here has not been Mars Saturn-y doom. I've certainly worked hard, but that's, you know, I would caution people from just looking at that one layer and thinking that that's enough to render a judgment. That is that is one important factor. And I would just also say, if we look at other systems that do this, if we look at traditional feng shui or vastu, the Indian feng shui, for lack of a better term. They both have a very, how should we say, precisely engineered intersection with the astrology. And that's more philosophically satisfying to me, is to understand the nature of the land and the nature of the sky, and to be able to put those two structures together. I feel like either one, no matter how good your understanding of one or the other is, if you don't have both shapes, you're kind of missing something.
Sure.
Which is not to say that I think relocational astrology is garbage, right? Just that seems so nice. And that there, you know, ideally there would be that intersection. Anyway, those are my thoughts on
definitely. It. Definitely. And I think Moses said something similar in terms of, you know, what's more important, like the natal chart or the relocated chart or lines. And he said, you know, the natal chart, definitely, that still has primacy over everything else, and this is just some other additional shade or perspective that you can get on things. So Kelly, and you've had some experiences with relocational astrology as well, right?
Yeah, and they've kind of been those experiences that I didn't know I was having until after, because I've only started, I guess, learning the theory of relocational or local space astrology, whatever the technical term is, in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. Partly because Frank Clifford wrote a feature in the 2017 Wellbeing Astrology on relocational astrology. So editing that was, you know, like a crash course. And I learned about some features of whether it's astrocartography or local space astrology, or local space horizon, I think it might be, that I didn't even know existed. But in terms of my personal experiences, when I was 29, I won a scholarship to go to UAC 2008, which was held in Denver, which I think is probably where I first saw you in the flesh, Chris, although I don't know that we actually met. Right. And while I was in Denver, I met a man who has gone on to become my husband. I met Mr. Scorpio, or my husband, Peter. And afterwards, I found out that I had a Saturn line running right through Denver. And I have Saturn in my natal chart in my seventh house. So I was in a place connected to a seventh house planet at the time of having a Saturn return, so a cycle activating the planet. And I met an older man who I fell madly in love with and ended up, you know, moving halfway around the world for. So that was my first sort of like, oh, wow, maybe there's something to this. Totally understanding that there was a couple of things going on, that the natal planet has a connection to the topic of the events that were activated there. And my husband and I say, if we had never met then, we can't understand how we would have ever crossed paths. He's right. Canadian. He lives in a small town outside Toronto. I'm Australian, and I've until meeting him, Sydney was my home and I never thought I would leave. And then this weird quirk of fate brings us together in this place in the world where I have this seventh house sort of activation, I guess, at the time where that planet is returning for the first time.
Yeah.
So I think it's a combination of the two. And then not realizing it, we then later on, of course, we're happy together and it's all very romantic. And we're like, okay, we're going to get married. Where will we get married? And we had always wanted to get married in Maui. And after the wedding, like months later, there's so many, if anyone has been married, there's so much to organize. Afterwards, I'm like, I wonder what lines I have that run in the middle of the Pacific. And my Venus line goes through the middle of the Pacific right near Hawaii.
Wow.
So that wasn't a conscious choice to go and get married on a Venus line. But in hindsight, it was like, and people say we did have this sort of very dreamy fairy tale, very Piscean style wedding. I mean, I did pick a wedding chart that had Venus at her exaltation degree in Pisces, which is probably not, which happens to sextile my natal Venus anyway. So I think to your point, Austin, there's definitely more than just this line at this time and, you know, this line always, but maybe this line and this place at a particular time or point in your life. So yeah, I've had a couple of kind of spooky experiences that sort of show me there's some validity to this that I'm interested to learn more about it.
Yeah, yeah. That was, you know, if I came off too critical earlier.
Oh, not at all.
Okay, well, just the positive side was that I absolutely can't dismiss the lines.
Yeah.
It's just that it's not enough.
No, I think the activation for whatever reason, maybe.
Well, and it's interesting because that your experience kind of speaks also partially to Austin's point, which is that, you know, that was a Saturn line that ran through there and you ended up having, it's not something you should have avoided, but in fact, it ended up being a very positive and very constructive experience overall. I mean, there might've been some like Saturn, you're going through your Saturn return. So of course there was like some Saturn stuff that came with it, but still.
Oh yeah. Like I was in another relationship when I met Peter. So there was all the backstory and the drama.
Minor details. I wasn't sure.
I was just trying to, you know, give the rosy. I mean, because, and at the time there was a lot of drama to do with that. My husband was in another relationship too. So it was very messy, mm-hmm. but you know, from our personal journey, it's like, well, that's, you know, there was a lot of sad shit in the beginning. That's
yeah,
sure.
Like constructive difficulties.
And, yeah.
Well, and that was also the period of time where Saturn and Uranus were doing oppositions.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I think by degree they weren't quite there yet because Uranus was a little later in Pisces and Saturn was more about mid-Virgo. But yeah, they were in signs. They were posing by sign for sure. And so I had a Saturn type event that had the Uranus side, the twist.
And it's interesting that there are those overlapping factors in terms of there being, it's like you natally had Saturn in Virgo and you're having your Saturn return and then you end up traveling to a place where your Saturn line is and that ends up being the most pivotal, coinciding with the pivotal event of the manifestation of that Saturn return transit.
It's phenomenal because I want to, okay, so how I couldn't afford to go to the conference, the UAC conference, because coming from Australia, it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. But I had done, in 2007, I had done my certification exams here in Australia. And weirdly, unusually, there was a scholarship available to the person who got the top marks around the country in 2007. It wasn't me. I came second. But the person who won the scholarship said, even with this amount of money, which I think was maybe $1,000, which would only cover half the airfare from Australia. Right. She's like, even with this money, I wouldn't be able to go. Please give it to someone who could use it.
Wow.
And that someone was me. And that was enough to get me across. So it wasn't just like deciding to go to the conference. And there were so many weird little things that came in, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
Yeah. Very weird.
All right. So
Austin,
okay,
you're going to go all over this.
No, I'm just using the Saturn return technique to time my relationship with my Saturn line.
Yes. Oh, cool.
Okay. So I said my Saturn line runs up and down the West Coast. I've been around here for about 10 years. Yeah. I moved out here like within a week of Saturn moving into to Virgo.
Wow.
And I met Kate, who is now my wife, within like, you know, within a month or two.
Right. Oh my gosh.
So Saturn rules my seven.
Yep.
So, okay. Yeah. No, I like this. I like this timing.
It's not bad.
That,
okay.
That
so
totally works.
So it
for
works
me.
For you too. And right, like our charts are similar in that we both have a Saturn seventh house connection. Mine is the planet inside and yours is the ruling planet of. So that makes sense that Saturn line activation at Saturn return would bring our partners. And it brought beautiful Kate to you.
It did. It did. You know, what's funny is I've lived, I've lived at several places in the West Coast. I've lived in LA and the Bay Area and Portland and now down in Ashland and up in Seattle. And so I've moved around a lot, but that Saturn line for me is basically vertical up and down the West Coast. Yep. So I've just been like going up and down that line ever since my Saturn return began.
Wow.
And so that's kind of
definitely
similar.
Something to this relocation business.
Yeah, I mean, and mine's not exact.
It's all made up.
I shared an anecdote with Moses that I was back around 2005. I was going through a heavy Neptune transit where it was moving over and conjoining the degree of my ascendant. And then I ended up moving across the country to Maryland to live at Project Hindsight. And that happened to be where my Neptune line ran exactly through that city. And everybody there had very prominent sort of Neptune placements, and it was a very interesting couple of years.
Was it very Neptunian?
I mean, Austin maybe can speak to that because he visited once. Was your week or two there pretty Neptunian?
I spent like 3 weeks there 2 years in a row. It was like a very odd summer camp. I would say that it was very Neptune and Aquarius. I would not say that it fits the parameters of Neptune and Pisces, but Neptune wasn't in Pisces.
No, it
then.
Wasn't. It was in Aquarius.
It was very mental.
Right.
Yeah.
So
it's a mind-bending type.
But I like that idea of perhaps, you know, somebody having a major transit involving a planet or a placement in their chart. And then sometimes if you go to a location that matches that line or makes it prominent in your located chart, perhaps that could be something that could prompt or trigger sort of the manifestation of that transit for better or worse. At least in those instances that we're talking about, that seems to be the case. So we'll have to look into that more.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one application that occurs to me right away is that somebody says to me, among other topics when I'm doing a reading, oh, hey, you know, and I was thinking about maybe moving, like not right now, but maybe by, you know, maybe beginning of the year. And I see that Uranus is about to move into their fourth. And then, you know, if I could just look at their relocation, see where the Uranus line is. Maybe Uranus is about to hit the ruler of the fourth. Look at where the line is for that, for the ruler of the fourth. Like that seems like an easy thing to just kind of check out to see if there are hits there.
Yeah.
Great point. Definitely.
Because people always ask you about moving.
Totally.
Right?
That's like, should I move? And if so, where should I go? It comes up all the time.
Yeah. And when it's like, I'm kind of thinking about, you know, maybe three locations.
Yeah.
Usually if people are really serious, they've usually thought about where they'd like to live.
Right.
The Lurgy's going round. I mean,
anyway.
We could probably go on about this topic for about 2 hours, Chris, by the sounds of it.
Sure. Yeah. I can move us on. So let's see. So we've touched on all of the major like preliminary announcement stuff. Kelly, you did have a workshop though. Did we mention that in Sydney?
Oh yeah. Sorry. I forgot that I do have a workshop next Friday, which I know is weird, but it's just what worked with the travel schedule. I'm doing an intro to Hellenistic and traditional concepts, basically. So for people who maybe are already working in astrology but are like, what is this whole sign business, or what does sect really mean, why is the ruling planet of the ascendant so important, for instance. So we're going to go through some of those main, I guess, Hellenistic-y type techniques or concepts, and then also look at how it might shift your chart. So if you've been working with your chart in a quadrant system like Placidus or Reggio or Porphyry, what changes and how does that shift the interpretation if we introduce these concepts? So that's what I'll be doing next Friday in Sydney. So yeah, I've got room for, you know, I've got a big space. So if anybody does want to join or has questions, the info is on my website, but you're also more than welcome to email me.
And is that the 29th or?
Oh, I beg your pardon. It's Friday, October the 6th.
6th. Okay. Got it.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah. So it'll be at the end of the school holidays here in Sydney.
Okay. What were you saying,
Austin?
So are you ready? Oh, I was going to say, so Kelly, are you ready to handle the whole sign-induced identity crisis trauma?
Yes. I feel like having gone through this a number of years ago, and now because I've switched my clients to that over the last three or four years, I feel like I'm ready to do that with a bunch of students. I'm excited because 99% of people who I've now started working with the whole sign shift in. I had a client email me this past week saying they were blown away with the insights that they got out of their whole sign chart and how that just seemed to resonate with them much more deeply. And so, yeah, I feel like when people say, well, what is the whole sign house system? My sort of soundbite response now is almost like it's the philosophical house system. It's kind of based on the meaning between, you know, the signs and the houses and then how that connects all to the ascendant. So it's not technically the same as some of the other house sisters, but it seems to hold something about the intention, the purest intention. So yeah, I'm open to that, Austin, and I'm ready to help people through that whole sign identity crisis.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I have a 29 degree rising.
Yeah, so you go through
and
it.
So I think one planet in my chart stayed in the same house.
Right. Yeah, and it's always the late degree ascendants that struggle the most with it because they have the biggest amount of house placement changes.
It's interesting seeing more established astrologers that go through that crisis process of if they do make that change and they do switch to whole sign houses, they often go through like an identity crisis and everything else just because they're oftentimes astrologers like views of themselves and their lives or their world are often become wrapped up so much in their own birth chart and in the charts of other people that they've looked at and things like that.
It's huge. It's huge.
Yeah. So that's like a real thing. We need there needs to be like a psychological support group for people going through that.
A therapy group.
Yeah. Right. All right.
Well, and that's, you know, I mean, that's part of why last year when you were discussing, or it's one of the reasons why last year when you were discussing house systems, that a lot of people had some very emotional responses.
Yes.
On every side of the debate, because it's literally a different portrait of your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, it's really just a different layer of the same portrait,
yeah.
Right? It's not like the angles change.
No.
But it's a very different angle. And for some people, it can be more or less flattering. And it's also weird to just, you know, everybody has an identity construct. And we make, you know, we carry around an image of ourselves in our lives that's based on everything we know about ourselves. And astrology is wonderful for teaching us things about ourselves.
Some things that we may not want to see or accept, but they're there anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, it's an interesting thing.
Definitely. All right. Well, I think on that note, maybe it's time to move on to the forecast. Let's do it. So I think we'll stick with the format of last time where we sort of go through sequentially rather than focusing in on, you know, what is the most major thing? Because I think some people have expressed in the past that they found that a little bit easier to follow. So what is our starting point, or what's the first thing that happens in October that really signals the move into the new month in terms of astrology?
Well, the first big thing, I guess, I'm thinking how close to the start of the month is the full moon?
Close enough. I mean, that's pretty much the first major astrology thing that happens in October, right?
Well, let me start then. Okay, so
yeah, you go, Austin.
There are a couple aspects on the first couple days of the month.
Right. Yeah.
So we got Mars trining Mars in Virgo, trining Pluto, and then Venus is right behind Mars, yeah. In Virgo, and so they both trine Pluto in quick succession, and so they're getting closer and closer. Venus is moving faster than Mars. And so Venus is just about to catch Mars and catches Mars in conjunction on the same day as the full moon.
Right.
And so what's really interesting about this is that the first couple days, all, you know, the main thing is the Mars-Venus dynamics with them both, you know, drawing closer, 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 both hitting Pluto. And then they can join within like an hour and a half of the full moon, and the full moon is in Aries. The full moon is in Aries and the sun is in Libra. So we have a full moon whose rulers are Venus and Mars. Mars ruling Aries and Venus ruling Libra, literally, you know, at the same moment that Mars and Venus are conjoining. And if you look at the antitia, it's in the Mars-Venus conjunction is in an almost perfect contra-intestinal relationship to the sun and moon. So that's a lot of Mars-Venus back and forth going on right there.
Right.
There is.
Right. And I'm just pulling up for the people joining the live stream or people watching the video version of this. I'm going to pull up the charts and sort of display them as we go, just to sort of visualize a little bit of what you're talking about. So we're focusing on the...
Yeah, easier to see.
Yeah, so we're focusing on this first week of October and especially around the time of the new moon, which takes place... Or sorry, the full moon, which takes place on October 5th, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that is at 12 degrees. It looks like the moon... So the moon is full. It hits its fullness at 12 degrees of Aries. And the sun is at 12 degrees of Libra.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting point, Austin, that you made, that the ruler of the sun and moon at the lunation are actually conjunct in Virgo. And then very close to squaring Saturn, too. So
indeed.
Yes.
They're both going to have to do that.
Right. That's so close. So it's right at 1917 or 1914 is the conjunction of Venus and Mars in Virgo.
Yeah. So as Austin's saying, it's basically happening on the day of the full moon.
It's happening within like an hour or two. It's super duper close.
Very interesting. And that's, you know, one of the things. So this is just after, because we talked about this and we focused a lot on it, but it's still so close at the time of this, that very last Jupiter-Uranus conjunction that we're coming out of, because it's still within like a degree or two of exact around 27, 28 Libra and Aries by this point.
Yeah, and there are a couple different moments within the month. Usually, it's the moon that hits either that Libra point or that Uranus point or a square from Pisces. Like the final moments of that Jupiter Uranus opposition get like re-fired up, because again, because they're both so slow, it's not like an aspect from Venus where it's like it happens and then 3 days later it's gone.
It's well gone.
Right. We're basically going to get that Jupiter Uranus firing aftershocks over and over again until Jupiter moves into Scorpio on the 10th.
Okay. Right. So that is going to be one of the big shifts. And that's one of the things that ingress will definitely, one of the reasons why it'll be a shift, in addition to Jupiter just like leaving Libra, it's finally getting free of this huge opposition that's been going on over the course of the past year.
Yeah. And so let's restrain ourselves from following up on that.
All right. I will.
Until we get to the portion of the month in which it occurs.
I will try. Okay. So full moon in Aries, October 5th. And not long after that, we get the Mercury Sun Superior conjunction on October 8th. And that actually, that comes up really quick. So pretty shortly after the full moon, basically, right?
Yeah, it's certainly in the making when the full moon takes place.
Absolutely.
Do you, before we move on from the full moon, do we have anything to say about it? And any delineation? We just kind of gave the technical outlines.
Yeah. I mean, Austin, you mentioned the Antitia. You mentioned contra-Antitia, I think. But isn't by Antitia that Venus-Mars conjunction at 11 Aries and therefore conjunct the moon?
There's an Antitia and
a contra-Antitia. Yeah. So the contra-Antitia is the opposition to the sun, but the
The contra is going to be conjunct the sun.
Oh, I beg your pardon. And the Antitia itself is conjunct the moon. Right. Got it. I mean, that's going to add in a shadowy component, right? That idea of behind the scenes or things being hidden, that mystery.
Well, and these are the rulers of both sides of the lunation behind the scenes, or seen through a mirror.
Yes.
Right? Like you can't see them directly, but you can see their shadows moving, or you can see a mirrored image, but you can't see them directly.
So like the smoke and mirrors, like the idea of like false presentation.
I don't know that I would read it that way, because in Antitia means that you actually have information you wouldn't otherwise have.
Right.
Like you can make out the form through the silhouettes as opposed to having no images whatsoever.
Got it.
I mean,
there's a level of speculation because you're pulling it from a silhouette rather than a physical thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but it also means that Venus and Mars can see the sun and moon, which it's their job to rule. I go back to basics, right? Full moon and Mars ruled Aries, having tension with the Sun and Venus ruled Libra, right? Libra says, oh, we can, let's make a deal. Let's compromise. Let's be balanced. Let's find the, you know, the point of equilibrium. And, you know, the moon in Aries, or the full moon in Aries, says, you know, what about what I want to do? It's, you know, it's the classic self versus other, mm-hmm. Or it's the me versus we full moon. Or it's like, what about the case for conflict? Well, what about the case for peace? And what's interesting is, you know, those are Venus and Mars's priorities, and they're right there together in Virgo. One of the things I imagine coming out of, and with Mercury right next to the Sun too, right? That's a lot of thinking about, you know, about what constitutes balance, what constitutes fairness. You know, when I was thinking about this for my monthly piece, deal making came to mind, right? Like deal making, like hashing mm-hmm. it out. But not just like, oh, here's, you know, here we go. Here, now we've all agreed on everything. But like working through Mars to get to Venus, and then maybe finding some more Mars and working that through that, like layers of like harmony, strife, strife, harmony, harmony, strife, and sort of like the, you know, he loves me not. And then you, what the last petal is, you don't know. But like that layering of harmony and strife, because that's so much Venus-Mars stuff with both the lights and the rulers conjoined and, you know, and all the factors that we delineated. Anyway, that was part of what I got from it.
Definitely. And I mean, one of the things that's interesting and that we dealt with in trying to look for electional charts in the beginning of the month was just the fact that Mercury and Venus are exchanging signs, or sort of loosely, you could say, in a sort of mutual reception during this part of the month. And the sort of reciprocal nature of that of a mutual reception between Libra and Virgo and the sort of exchange taking place, but the weird kind of balancing act that's going on where you have Mars in there with Venus in Virgo at the same time and Jupiter, at least temporarily, at least for the first week or so, still in Libra with Mercury. And just what a mutual reception. I mean, is it okay with using the term mutual reception for an exchange of like two planets between signs, even if there's not an aspect between them? This is something that came up recently in one of my courses. And so we had a discussion about the concept of reception and mutual reception, exchanging signs. But I'm always curious how other astrologers use those terms or concepts.
I much prefer they have an aspect. Contra-antitia is just fine.
So you'd view that as a mutual reception because there's a contra-antitia and they're exchanging domiciles?
Yep. And there, you know, there are other ways to use this. Like you could have, you know, to use that term, you know, you can have a mutual reception by bound or by triplicity or all, you know, you can, or by exaltation if you want to, you know, get medieval and Renaissance. But in terms of like what I guess people have come to associate with mutual reception, you know, by if it's by rulership and there is either a classical aspect or there's an antitial relationship or a contra-antitial relationship, thumbs up. That's a real mutual reception, or that's a full strength mutual reception, not to get into real versus unreal.
Sure. That makes sense. So there can be like a gradation or different levels of it, depending on, you know, what the specifics are.
Yeah. Right. Like that's gotta be stronger than a mutual reception by bound.
Right.
Absolutely.
All right. And in terms of, you know, does that become one of the major signatures for the early part of the month then, in terms of that emphasis on those two signs with Libra and Virgo, do you guys feel like?
Look, I think it's what I would say too around this, it's highlighting the Aries Libra axis again. Mm-hmm. So that's just been triggered by the third and final Jupiter Uranus opposition at the end of September. Then we have a full moon. Not at the same degrees, but certainly in the same signs and activating, you know, the same houses in your chart, depending on what house system you're using. And at the very end of the month, which I know we will get to, we'll have another lunation that is activating Uranus. So it does feel just generally that this Aries Libra polarity, when I think Austin, you said it beautifully around that idea of harmony and strife and the dance between, you know, agreement versus negotiation or even disagreement, is a bit of an underlying theme, probably from late September to late October, but it sort of peaks at these punctuation points around the lunations. And this is the first one. And then, as you said to Chris, like having Mercury, or maybe Austin had said this, Mercury is right there with the sun, in many ways exacerbating that indecisive or to and fro, back and forward energy that is already there with the Libra influence.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, agree 100%.
Definitely. And in terms of that theme of like harmony versus strife, with that conjunction taking place right there in Virgo, one of the things I'm always constantly sort of sometimes like amused by is just like how much, we often talk about Virgo being detail oriented, but how like a large part of the archetype of Virgo ends up being this general theme of like the small things or the smaller things as contrasted with Pisces, which tends to be much more the larger things or the big picture. So, I mean, maybe part of the theme of that conjunction is like harmony versus strife, but that's taking place within the context of looking at the details, or is hashed out partially by working with the details and those being crucial towards finding that balance that's kind of indicated there by that conjunction.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's like placing many small things on the scales, right? Well, there's this one little thing, and then there's that. And you know, like that's, you know, that fits really cleanly into any image of deal making, right? Like if you're looking at legal deals, it's like, well, you know, we're going to have to get rid of this line of the agreement, and I want to add this line. It's like, well, okay, well, if you do that, then I want to add this, right? Little, you know, and if you've ever played with like an actual scale or balance, and they have those, they're like little tiny metal things where there'll be like 1 gram or whatever. And just like putting what you like to balance them, you have to put one on here and you're like, oh, that's too much. And you put two of these over here. Like it's very that world. But yeah, I don't know. It definitely feels like a harmony and strife tiramisu or lasagna where it's like layered.
Right.
I love that, Austin. Your images are so good.
And in connection with that, I mean, the other thing that I noticed, because it came out because it's something that I overlooked last month in working with some elections, and then it came up in a really striking way, but not being able to get away from the fact that a lot of these conjunctions and planets transiting through those degrees of Virgo are like running smack into that square with Saturn at 22 degrees of Sagittarius. And that's sort of an overlaid concept with that conjunction, is it's not just some sort of pure conjunction with Venus and Mars in Virgo, and then it's like exchanging signs with Mercury, but it's like Saturn's in this pretty pivotal location and they're all basically getting ready to run into it, or both getting ready to run into it.
Yeah. A couple things. One, after that Venus Mars conjunction is complete on the 5th, Venus has a couple more days until it completes the square with Saturn. And that's a pretty classic enclosure besiegement by malefics. Like Venus is getting hit on both sides by the malefics there. And I think the moon, like there's the moon sends one ray of silvery hope from Taurus. But other than that, it's a pretty rough place for Venus to be. And generally, you know, when Venus is afflicted in the skies, like Venusian things don't tend to go well, or it's, you know, it's hard to find your joy. Your joy is some, you know, has gone off and hidden somewhere and it'll come back. But that can be, you know, periods of time where Venus is afflicted are painful, or they're not necessarily painful, but they may be painful. But oftentimes there's a conspicuous lack of pleasure.
Right.
And then, you know, that Mars-Saturn square that you're looking at right there, and that's Mars in Virgo squaring Saturn in Sagittarius at 22. The moon opposes that actually on the 3rd, which makes for a perfect besiegement from malefics. And the moon also hits it there on the 10th, which puts the moon in a perfect T-square with Mars and Saturn. And then once it's departing but still close, when the moon's in Virgo and conjunct Mars, you also have another brief besiegement. And so those aren't monthly themes, but there are a few nasty moments that are provided by that Mars-Saturn square beyond the day that it simply occurs. And so those would be my anti-electional moments. Like, don't schedule anything important for the, you know, it's only about 12 hours out of the whole month, but it's like, that's not a good time to do things unless you're intending to do something destructive. In which case, I guess that's an election. But for, you know, for 99% of what we want to do, those are moments to avoid.
Right. Like, it makes me think of some of those terrible, like, elections in the Picatrix, where it's like, if you want to make a talisman in order to exterminate a rat or vermin or something like that, then make this terrible looking, use this terrible alignment of planets.
Yeah. In one translation, they say, bring evil to the ascendant.
Yes.
Which is saying bring one of the infortunes, right? One of the malefics to the ascendant and have the other one in the 10th. But yes, this is, I suppose, if you want to bring evil to the ascendant.
Sure. So somebody asked, and I think this is going to be in the next Q&A episode, but it was actually such a good question. It might be relevant here. Where somebody asked me, you know, what do you, and I haven't introduced the electional chart this month, but I'll get to it pretty soon. But they were like, what do you use those electional charts for? Or if you know when some of the good charts are in a given month, like what types of things do you even use them for? And, you know, for me and for Lisa, because we're always sort of aware of what the electional charts are on a given day throughout the month, and we're often, you know, often we have like solar flare running in the background. So we even sort of know what the rising sign is in different parts of the day. If we're actually working on things, I mean, we're often generally using that for general purpose things, like even something as simple as like sending an important email or scheduling like a meeting or having like an event or something like that. Sometimes recording podcast episodes, I try to pick a good electional chart to whatever extent I can. But sometimes I go back and forth between thinking like, you know, this is really, you know, a good application of astrology versus like, you know, am I just being neurotic, like electing all of these small things and what the line is between those two. Have you guys found a comfortable balance between those things yourselves, or where do you fall when it comes to that?
A comfortable balance. I don't know if it's a comfortable balance, but I mean, and Chris, what you said, I'm like, people may not know this, but as working astrologers, when I'm at my computer, I have Soulfire open and I'm in and out of it all day long. So right. I'm very aware of the moon changing signs, for instance. You know, the amount of times I think, God, I just want to go and do nothing for a couple of hours. And sometimes I do. And I realize the moon is at 28 or 29 degrees of her sign. Or I'll sit down at the computer with this spur of inspiration or motivation and just get heaps of stuff done in 20 minutes and realize the moon has just ingressed into a new sign. So look, I think as working astrologers, we are looking all the time. And I do the same thing you guys do. If I've got to send a newsletter, I think, oh, look, that ascendant's a bit nicer than the one that's happening now. I'll delay sending the newsletter by an hour or two, or there's a much better time tonight and I'll, you know, schedule it for then. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for meetings and social events too. I mean, sometimes social planning, if Peter and I are hosting something, I'll think, no, we don't want to do it that night. The balsamic moon, everyone won't want to come out of their houses or something. Balsamic moon in Cancer is not ideal for hosting a party. But a full moon's a great time and everyone will get drunk off two drinks or something. So there's from simple things to, oh my God, the moon squaring Saturn, no wonder I'm under the deadline, to you know, more technical things. So I absolutely, there are some times where it's like, I just have to do this now. And I, you know, it doesn't matter what the astrology says, this has whatever task it is.
Right.
But certainly to the extent that it's possible, absolutely.
Okay, good. That makes me feel slightly better.
Yeah. I'm like, you're not neurotic. I mean, I don't know. I'm just assuming that all astrologers do this, but maybe you don't, Austin. I don't know.
Oh no. Yeah. I
think we all do.
Okay.
I also filter through planetary days and hours.
That's the other thing I do, is planetary hours as well.
I always have those open. Yeah. I structure a fair amount of my workday around that. Like I always try to do like a solid block of writing on the Venus Mercury hours, which are sequential. You know, I always break for food and sanity during the moon hour. you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Nice. And yeah. have you worked SolarFire into your like workflow, Austin, now that you have it? Or are you still getting used to, I know you just got it in the past few months. On your way, more or less.
Yeah, it's getting there. I obviously use it, but I'm still getting to know how to tell it to show me what I want to see.
Yeah, I mean,
right, and so I do sometimes just default to old tools that are probably inferior, but I know how to use them. I'm just like, just show me this. I don't want to spend 20 minutes figuring this out. I just want to, you know, I just want this, and I want to do something else. So it's getting there. It's obviously. There's obviously a lot there, and that's actually, I would say, both the advantage and at this point the problem for me. I'm learning.
Yeah, I had a really hard time transferring from AstroDeans to SolarFire at first, just because I was so used to looking at the chart designs of Astro.com, and I couldn't get SolarFire to look exactly the same, and it really bugged me for a long time, but eventually I got over that.
I would say the shift of software is actually as discombobulating as changing house systems.
Yeah.
To definitely. Go back to that. Yeah,
with maybe less personal implications.
For sure. You haven't changed your personal self-view, but to look at a chart, because I first used Astro.com in the beginning too, and the SolarFire chart display is so different. And I remember just taking my time with that. Now when a student throws an Astro.com chart in front of me, I almost want to like gag because it's just not as clear. But that's also just because I'm conditioned to looking at SolarFire style charts. So Austin, I can totally understand, you know, that time for transition.
Yeah. When there's also like 30 different styles of charts in SolarFire.
Right.
So I'm like, I haven't found one that I really love. I'm like, that has the information.
Yeah.
You might like this. I just released I only did like one video last month because I've been sort of lost on other things, but I released a tutorial and I released my chart design. So the chart design you're looking at right now on your screen, I released the files for that as well as a tutorial for installing it if you happen to want to use this chart design. So just check it out.
I like that
on my
a lot.
YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/theastrologyschool. And I also found out that actually talking to SolarFire people that we still get that discount. So there's still a podcast discount that in effect, if anyone wants to buy SolarFire and get a 15% discount, just enter the promo code AP15 during checkout and you just get like a 15% discount for just being a podcast listener. So definitely.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty useful. And, you know, being able to like use the program and something I use all the time and be able to offer something like that. All right, so that was a nice digression. We were talking about the Mercury-Saturn.
Oh, elections,
We were talking about the Mars-Saturn square and the Venus-Saturn square that's going to take place around the second week of October, basically, is when that stuff starts hitting.
I've got the dates here in Eastern time zone of the 8th of October for Venus square Saturn.
Okay.
And the 11th of October for Mars square Saturn.
And Austin, like you raised a really important point, just looking at Venus as a general significator and saying like Venus type things are affected sometimes in general. And that's something I had always been uncomfortable with, the idea of just using general significators, especially in a mundane context. But I'm becoming more and more comfortable and more realizing that that's actually really a relevant and important thing that you've got to pay attention to just on a regular basis in terms of what the transits are. But also in terms of electional charts as well, that it's not always just about looking at the unique rulers of the houses in a specific nativity, but sometimes something as simple as what we're doing here, which is talking about the state of general significators like Venus for relationships or Mercury for communication or something like that, can be super relevant and super descriptive of just what's going on in people's lives at the time.
Yeah, and especially when you filter a planet's general condition through planetary days and hours, it's really obvious. Mm. Like, afflicted Venus Fridays are not fun.
No.
You know, Mars retrograde Tuesdays are pain, right? Exalted Mercury Wednesdays are fantastic.
And Venus in rulership Fridays are fabulous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, I remember, you know, the first Sunday after the sun ingressed into Leo this summer, I was just like, oh, it's so good.
Yes.
It's so good. Oh, it's so good. Oh, it's so sweet.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's a way to like specify that. So you're not looking for that planet all the time. you know, just like look to assess matters connected to that planet on the days and hours. And that's, you know, you can, there are 1,000 apps that you can just have open that'll tell you that. Although you may not sit at your astro computer all day long like all of us do. So
you may have a real life to attend to.
Right. Although I do have in the chart design a little planetary day and hour thing. So you'll be happy about that, Austin. We'll have to set that up later and see how you like it.
So to summarize that, guys, nice. Austin, you're basically saying Venus hours and Venus days will be quite craptastic in this period where Venus is seriously afflicted.
Yeah, things are hard on Venus. So what's interesting about the 8th, right, is we have like Venus, Venus had to do a conjunction with Mars and then a square with Saturn.
But then
like things are starting to get better. Like Venus, nobody harasses Venus after she clears the square with Saturn. And then Venus gets to move into Libra for more than the second half of the month. But before we move on to that, the 8th, you know, when Venus squares Saturn is also when we have Mercury conjoining the Sun. That's the superior square. And I love, or superior square, superior conjunction. So that's Mercury on the far side of the Sun, right? Which looks the same on a chart as Mercury between us and the Sun, because they're all, you know, Earth, Mercury, and the Sun are all in a line. But the superior conjunction, which is the one we're doing in October, is on the far side. And usually I love the superior conjunctions. There's probably a lot to love about this one, but it is square Pluto within a degree. It's really tight.
Wow. Very tight. Yeah.
And so that's happening the same day that Venus makes that square to Saturn. And so what's kind of wacky about that is if we're looking, you know, as Chris pointed out about Venus in Virgo is ruled by Mercury. Mm-hmm. Mercury in Libra is ruled by Venus. Right. We have both sides of that mutual reception doing some interesting and challenging things.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting and challenging. And then I think, okay, we've got this period where we've just got these really dramatic square aspects coming out. And one very basic key word or concept that I always think about interpreting for a square is the idea of adjustment. The idea that neither party in that arrangement gets to move forward without some sort of negotiation or compromise. And I mean, we've got Libra involved here and Venus anyway, but it is that idea of the frustration of not being able to get the alignment or the alliance that you need, or to realize, I mean, if we're talking, you know, Saturn to Venus, that idea that there are things preventing what you might prefer or you might choose that have to be addressed, that you have to adjust, you know, even though you don't want to. And the Sun-Mercury-Pluto combination, I'm really interested to see, because I think Mercury going into Kazemi is very powerful for picking up those bits of information or those important pieces of data that have been maybe overlooked or we didn't have access to yet. And now we've got access to something that had previously been obscured. And because that's happening with the square to Pluto, I'm really intrigued, even just at a personal micro level, how people get some sort of revelation or new information that comes forward then. And what they do with that because of the Pluto component. I don't know if you guys had thought about from an interpretive perspective for these pieces.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about that is you could really treat this, if you wanted to, as the beginning of Mercury's cycle. I mean, on the one hand, Mercury conjoining the Sun is like literally halfway between retrograde periods or between retrograde stations, like the last direct station and the next retrograde station. And so if you were to treat any point of any planet's sort of cycle and to try to find a beginning, it's usually going to be the direct conjunction with the Sun. And so in some way, this is like kind of flavoring the whole starting point of this new cycle for Mercury with that square with Pluto.
Yeah. And it's, you know, God, it's more deal making, you know, the sitting down and talking with both of you about the, you know, first 2 weeks of this month, the image and energy of haggling.
Yeah.
And of like back and forth and thinking your position, whether it's like haggling with, you know, your own balance. Like, so how am I moving forward into this season? You know, whether it's, you know, just about you and your own life, or, you know, with, in a close personal relationship or a business relationship, it's very like back and forth. And, you know, it's like, I suppose there, in addition to harmony and strife in that tiramisu, there's also this sort of thinking and rethinking and formulating and reformulating based on the last, you know, layer you ate.
Right. And I mean, one of the things we might want to do is sometimes it's useful, and I meant to always push us to do more of this, but sometimes just try to like throw out or generate some keywords for some of the combinations that we're using. So, you know, the Venus Mars one was great. But for Mercury and Pluto, I mean, lately in looking at some Pluto stuff recently, I'm just always surprised at how much some of the sort of cliche keywords of like compulsion and like manipulation or control and like power issues often really do become very prominent in Pluto type dynamics.
Yep. Secrets.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the secrets, but I think the manipulation, because I think that's one of the shadow sides to the sign of Libra, isn't it? That, you know, they seem to be very compromising on the surface, or planets in Libra, but they can somehow be pulling strings. So definitely that idea of, you know, what's not being said or what's going on behind the scenes from that manipulation piece. I mean, I think if you wanted to get obsessed about a research project, that could be a really helpful energy. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because that also that combines one of the traditional, you know, placements that was associated with secrecy, which is being under the beams in general. Mm. And so Mercury here is pretty much as far under the beams as you can get it by having that exact conjunction with the sun. But then it's also squaring sort of a modern planet that I think most modern astrologers would associate with those types of themes like secrecy.
Absolutely. I think the secrecy comes up from both a modern and traditional perspective with this component.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Any other like Mercury, Pluto type things that you guys want to mention in terms of keywords or like significations associated with that?
Well, okay. So Mercury, Pluto, definitely going down rabbit holes, obsession. You know, if you're actually doing a research project, that's good probably, but you know, just going from YouTube video to YouTube video is probably not a research project. No. You can totally get, you know, like if you consider that you have an extra ability to get sucked into little reality tunnels and thinking tunnels during that time period. If you pick your wormhole, you'll be better off rather than just kind of randomly, you know, stumbling down one.
Right. Yeah, I love that. That's a great image for Mercury Pluto aspects, which sometimes if it's like a soft aspect, sometimes that sort of compulsion can be, you know, like a driving force that can be channeled in a productive way. But sometimes when it's a more difficult aspect, it can be difficult not to get sucked into that, like a sort of black hole focusing you in on something that can become unproductive or like unhealthy as a sort of like obsession in some sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, I was just going to say just very quickly, I think the negative of that obsession, that mental obsession, is becoming really fixated on something or overly anxious or stressed about something, where you cause yourself this mental turmoil because you cannot set something down or let it go. So I definitely think there's a time wasting potential here as well.
I would say that there's also a potential for, yeah, I totally agree. Letting suspicions overflow,
yeah,
and letting distrust multiply itself.
Right. Yeah. Like that kind of brings us like to the conspiracy theory thing we jumped on or talked about very briefly last month. This would be a good sort of combination. Like Mercury Pluto would be a good thing about that, like becoming obsessed about, you know, suspicions or theories that other people might have, that there might be like a vast conspiracy or there might be underhanded things afoot, and becoming sort of obsessed with that as an idea, sometimes to like an unhealthy extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sure. All right. So at this point, we're getting into were around the second week of October. So why don't we fully move into that second week here at this point? And maybe one of the good transition points, I don't know if there's anything I'm overlooking, but Austin, I really like the point you made that, you know, once Venus has that square with Saturn on October 8th or around October 8th, it starts separating both from the square with Saturn and the conjunction with Mars and heading towards its home sign of Libra. So Venus's condition basically starts improving from October 8th forward and then just keeps getting successively better, I think. First starting October 8th with separating from the square. And then finally, by October 14th, we have the ingress of Venus into Libra. And Venus then spends a few weeks or like a month or something in its own sign at this point, right?
Yeah, which just makes everything better.
Yes.
And we get, what's interesting is we get both of the benefics, both Jupiter and Venus, changing signs over, you know, like four days, right? Jupiter moves into Scorpio on the 10th. And then is it early 14th that Venus moves into Libra?
Yeah, it looks like here in Denver, for example, it looks like it goes in between 4 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the morning on October 14th.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, those are both big shifts. And Jupiter will be with us for basically, you know, more or less a year, or more a year. And, you know, Venus will be with us for the rest of the month. And, you know, one thing I like about Venus in Libra when there are planets in Libra is that all, you know, I always think of, when I think of Libra and the scales and balance within relationships and justice within the world, and also the balance in trade, you know, scales are used in trade as much as they're used in justice. Deals need to be fair, right? Is that Venus is the fulcrum. Venus provides the center point, which allows you to find the balance between the two scales. And when Venus is in Libra, it's like, ah, the scale's working perfectly. It just makes it easier for the other planets, which are operating according to that formula, which in this case will be the Sun and Mercury. It allows them to both do their Libra things so much more easily, which is nice because, you know, if we look at the month up to this point, there's a lot of trying to get the scales to balance, but there's a lot in the way.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And well, it's go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say, yeah, it I think it's going to bring a very welcome and very positive change.
So, and it's funny talking about this because this actually, Lisa and I looked through the electional charts. Well, mainly Lisa looked through the electional charts because she's really the expert, like electional astrologer at this point. And then we go over them together afterwards, but we were trying to decide which one to highlight. And of the ones that she came up with, I actually wanted to highlight this one, which takes place on October 14th at about 5:30 in the morning with early Libra rising. So right after Venus goes into Libra, it opens up this kind of brief window that takes place during the second part of October, the second half of October, where you can get some relatively decent Venus elections where Venus is in its own sign. It's not really afflicted by anything through super close hard aspects with malefics now that it's sort of clearing or cleared that Saturn square and cleared the conjunction with Mars. So the main electional chart that I wanted to highlight this month for this episode is this one. So October 14th, 5:30 in the morning, early Libra rising and Venus having just ingressed into Libra. Which hopefully you can get in every location. I think most locations can get this. It might be a little bit dicey with some of them, but so it has Libra rising with Venus in Libra in its own sign in the first house, or at least closely conjunct the ascendant, depending on what house system you're using. It is a night chart because this is a bit before sunrise. You actually have an option where you could make it a day chart if you want to by putting the ascendant a little bit later and doing it at or just after sunrise and putting the Sun and Mercury on the ascendant. But it would actually be better in terms of sect and in terms of really emphasizing Venus's placement if you kept it as a night chart, because then Venus will be at its most positive in terms, both in terms of sect and in terms of zodiacal placement, while ruling the first house, while ruling the ascendant. And therefore, whatever you're starting or initiating at that time will be primarily signified by Venus in your chart. And Austin, I think you'll like this. This is also taking place on the day of Venus as well. So extra bonus points in terms of Venus. So this is really, you know, trying to emphasize this almost like a Venus electional chart. And so you'd want to use it. Ideally, you could use it for Venus type things. So that could be something as simple or as sort of mundane as like beauty type things or things where aesthetic appeal is really important. But more broadly, you could also use it for things that are in accordance with Venus's basic nature of trying to like unify and reconcile things. So if you're trying to, you know, make peace with somebody that you've had problems with in the past, if you're trying to create some sort of group endeavor that requires a sort of cohesive focus, then this might be a good chart. The other, you know, major point about this chart or the other thing is the placement of the moon, which we couldn't get super well placed. And there's a little bit of question about putting it that close to the north node, since in some electional texts, putting the moon conjunct the north node is not super recommended. But in terms of trying to find one of the best Libra rising Venus and Libra charts this month, this is one of the best ones we could come up with.
It's applying to the sun by sextile, which is
with reception because it's in Leo, the sun's domicile. So the moon's, you know, relatively well placed. It's in the later part of its waning cycle. It's not necessarily applying to benefics, but it's not severely harmed by malefics either. And it has that nice applying sextile with reception with the sun.
Yeah, I think we could all agree that the sun and moon are friends.
Absolutely.
Especially when they're in a sextile.
Yeah, definitely. And so that, you know, because the moon is in the 11th house that and it rules the 10th house, that kind of emphasizes some of those notions of friendship and alliances and unity and other things like that. So sort of circling around to that point that somebody had a question on earlier, which was, you know, what do you do with charts like these? On the one hand, you could use it for very specific or highly focused sort of Venus type affairs or 11th house type affairs. But on the other hand, it is just because the ruler of the ascendant and the moon are relatively well situated, this is kind of a good chart for a lot of things where because you don't have major afflictions going on of the principal significators in the electional chart, you could use it for a lot of different projects and they're just going to tend to pick up a very Venusian or Venus and Libra type vibe in whatever it is that you're starting at that time.
Yeah, this is this is basically a Venus talisman election. Yeah. You know, most talismans, I mean, there are a lot, but the main kind are just like single planet elections. And this is basically of that sort. And this would probably work just fine for a Venus and Libra talisman, you know, depending on where you are in the world. And what the hours are, because the planetary hours are going to be a little different.
Oh, good point. And you actually, I mean, you used something not super different from this for your wedding chart, didn't you? It was like Taurus rising with Venus and Libra or something like that.
Yeah. It was an interesting Venus and Mars had just come off a conjunction in Virgo, and it was Venus moving into Libra. And getting that sign boundary between her and Mars. But yeah, not dissimilar.
Brilliant. Okay. So that's the electional chart that I wanted to highlight for this month, the one electional chart of like one of my best elections that we could find this month. We've got three or four other charts that we're going to present in this month's Auspicious Elections podcast, which Lisa and I are going to be recording in the next few days and then releasing to patrons of the Astrology Podcast who are on the $5 or $10 tiers as one of the exclusive benefits of those Patreon tiers. So if you want to listen to that episode and get those other electional charts, you can find out more information at theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe and going to our page on Patreon. All right, so that's the election for this month, and that's taking place on October 14th. So at this point, we're in the two main things this month. I mean, one of them, of course, is the Venus ingress into Libra, but the big elephant in the room, of course, is the shift of Jupiter into Scorpio.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
All right. So we've had a year of Jupiter in Libra here at this point, and by October 10th, it looks like Jupiter departs from Libra and makes its way into 0 degrees of Scorpio. So, and that's where it's going to be for the next 12 months or so, basically, right?
Yeah, 12 plus.
12 plus.
It's about 13.
Okay. So what do you guys think about that? How are you, we're getting into like the period of time where I can think back 12 years ago pretty well and think about Jupiter and Scorpio and like remember what that was like pretty clearly in terms of my study of astrology and understanding and like awareness of the planetary transits at that point. So I'm kind of interested that getting to that stage in my career where I can remember like outer planet transits like that 12 years ago. Do you guys have a similar like recollections about 12 years ago, Jupiter going through Scorpio?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We actually met during Jupiter and Scorpio.
Oh, yeah. That actually, yeah, that makes sense. So that would have been during that the summer of 2006. And that was my first year at Project Hindsight. And learning Hellenistic astrology was largely under that Jupiter and Scorpio transit.
Yeah, it's almost like Jupiter went over all of your Scorpio planets and you learned something.
You learned something.
As if I had one or two planets in Scorpio and Jupiter transited.
Yeah, just like that.
It's really, that my dad, who's a grandma, you know, he's very specific about word choice. He would be all over you guys. Was it like that or was that what it was?
Right.
That's what we grew up hearing.
I think that your dad would appreciate my sarcasm and understand that I'm actually a great appreciator of the rules of grammar.
Yes.
And when I break them, it is because I decided.
Because you,
my mother was an English.
Oh
teacher.
Right, okay, still, yes.
That'll do it.
And that, by the way, that's funny, Kelly, with us both having our Saturn and a Mercury ruled sign, and having like a clear familial experience of proper language.
My dad, you know, the Australian equivalent of something like the New York Times newspaper. My dad would read it on a Saturday with a red pen and correct
My mom does.
Yeah.
The same
oh my
thing.
Gosh, Austin, that's hilarious. And then, of course, we do have Saturn in Virgo, so we appreciate the proper rules of particularly Mercury things.
They were explained very clearly
from a very young age.
That seems like especially like a Mercury in Earth signs in general, like Virgo, especially but also Capricorn. I mean, I remember I had a teacher where, unlike you guys, my grammar is not as good, or I'm not as focused on that. But it was like a Mercury and Capricorn teacher that was very good about, you know, constantly asking and reminding about, you know, the rules of grammar and how important that is in terms of sentence structure. But it's something I've noticed, especially with Mercury in Earth signs.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's the form of things.
Right. What is the physical
form? It doesn't matter what you...
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you meant. This is what you created is shaped like, and it is deformed.
Right. Whereas Mercury in like a water sign might be more like what was it felt, like what was the feeling you were intending to convey with whatever word salad you just put together.
Yeah, word salad.
I feel you, bro. I feel where you're coming from.
All right. So Jupiter and Scorpio.
Funny.
Kelly, do you remember Jupiter and Scorpio for you 12 years ago?
Actually, I do. And I feel like that's how we're old enough to know that we remember it last time. Personally, I remember it being subjectively good, more just from that like learning and growing and developing perspective. I think it was a ninth house transit for me. The thing that keeps coming up, and maybe I should have researched this before we spoke today, I feel like there was something that was talked about in terms of like maybe secrets to do with the royal family, and maybe there was stuff that went on with Prince Charles or something at that time, but I'd need to look into it. You know, that idea of maybe there being some revelations, I remember that being talked about last time, but maybe that's a weird memory. I really enjoyed it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome.
I'm not scared of the dark, I should say.
Sure.
Yeah, I really liked it subjectively. To offer a frame that is not entirely based on my experience.
Sure.
Jupiter in Libra is, it's not a bad sign for Jupiter, but Jupiter had his work cut out for him this last year. You know, Jupiter and Libra was like, how about peace? And Uranus and Aries was like, how about shut up? And, you know, Jupiter and Libra was like, how about we, you know, everybody, it'll be okay. And Pluto and Capricorn was like, how about you shut up? You know, there's, you know, Jupiter was basically, you know, T squared by Uranus and Pluto all year on and off. And so there was nothing that Jupiter and Libra tried to do that didn't get extra complicated. And when I think about the good things that were indicated for me this year with Jupiter in Libra, those happened and ended up being way more complicated, which isn't to say, you know, that good turned to bad, but just that the complications implied by Jupiter being opposed by Uranus and squared by Pluto were abundantly clear. And now, as it's almost in retrospect, are even more abundantly clear. Right. And Jupiter in Scorpio isn't going to fight with anybody.
That's a really good point, Austin, the aspects.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's going to yell at Jupiter to shut up, you know? Jupiter's going to be like, hey, guys, I learned this really important philosophical lesson by watching this horror movie. And the other planets will be like, oh, that's really interesting.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's crucial. So there's no other outer planets that it's going to hit during the course of that trip through Scorpio for the most part.
Well, I mean, it'll trine Neptune and Pisces, and Neptune and Pisces will be like, tell me more.
Yeah. And that'll happen early in December. I'm quite looking forward to that. But that's...
Well, and then I think the station degree is the direct station degree way later in the year is pretty close to Neptune too. But that's like,
it's a trine to Neptune, and they're both in water signs. Yeah,
they're both in water signs. You know, Scorpio likes it dark, but Pisces can totally deal with the dark.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it'll be nice to have a Jupiter that's not impeded at every turn. So especially if you're a very Jupiterian nativity, it's probably going to feel good. If you're used to leading with Jupiter, this last year has probably not been, there've probably been some frustrations with that. Whereas what's interesting, because Jupiter in Scorpio doesn't have a rack load of, traditional dignity, but it's not debilitated, right? It just does, just, you know, it's kind of just going to get to do its thing. Yeah. And I mean, it does rule the second face, which is, in one system, which is nice. But yeah, it's, and I don't know, it's, I think when I think of Jupiter and Scorpio, I think of, the less celebrated quality of Jupiter, which is not to, people like to celebrate Jupiter's distribution of opportunities and wonderful lessons. But the other thing that Jupiter does is it negates negatives. It helps you fix things that aren't working. And I think that Jupiter and Scorpio will have an orientation that's closer to that. On a psychological level, like, it's totally, you know, it's time to integrate with your shadow, or, you know, whichever psychology's language you use to phrase that process. But it's like going down into the underworld and finding out that you can be friends with a lot of the monsters, and maybe they'll even do stuff for you.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and Austin, what you're reminding me of, Sean Nygaard, if I'm saying his name properly, wrote a beautiful article in the Wellbeing Astrology on Jupiter and Scorpio. And he made this beautiful point about the storyteller. And he lists a bunch of really well-known storytellers who actually have Jupiter and Scorpio in their birth chart, including Stephen King. Which I think is fascinating. So Stephen King, Alfred Hitchcock, Danielle Steele, who writes more romance-y type, if that's what they're called.
Oh no, they're I'm pretty sure those are like tawdry bodice rippers.
Yes,
which is very Scorpio. And then Stephen King and Alfred Hitchcock with suspense and mystery and suspicion.
And Shonda Rhimes, who's the showrunner or creator of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. And I don't know if anybody has watched Scandal, but that is the most trippy show. And it's ultimately about power and control. And there's all these shadowy power organizations. Like, you think the president's in control, but there's this shadowy organization called B613 that really runs the show. And who's running that? So there's all these themes there. So when you mentioned the horror movie, I was like, actually, the Stephen King thing kind of does really fit. So it's that idea of storytelling where maybe there's a message or there's something to be gained, but we go into those very Scorpio topics to get there.
Yeah, totally. I was thinking about philosophical horror the other day when I was considering Jupiter in Scorpio. Well, I mean, you know, if you H.P. Lovecraft, which is one of the, you know, sort of, I don't know, gods in the pantheon of horror literature, the philosophical elements were part of what made it work. And most people don't think of philosophical horror, but if you, you know, did an undergraduate in philosophy, you know that philosophy is full of horror. and that, you know, that there's a penetrating, you know, because Jupiter's about learning, right? But if you go, once you get, you will always get to a certain point in your learning where you will learn something about the world which you have not yet accepted.
Yes.
Right? Like, and Chris, stop me if I'm wrong here, but part of your deep ingress into Hellenistic astrology meant having to confront questions of fate and free will, which you hadn't before, which were not necessarily super happy. You know, like the implication that maybe I'm making far fewer choices than I imagined I was. Maybe I'm the puppet of forces I do not understand. Right? Like these are things you have to grapple with when you go deep.
Yeah, I mean that was a large part of that ingress to me. And actually, now that you mention it, that whole process probably started very shortly after the ingress of Jupiter into Scorpio, which was being exposed to and finally learning and understanding how to use some of the Time Lord systems like Zodiac releasing, and then suddenly having a technique that seemed to be like outlining, you know, the outlines of a person's entire life from the moment of birth, but then also sometimes indicating that they would make certain choices deliberately at certain points in their life. And then the philosophical crisis that suddenly came along with that over the course of the next year or so of what does this mean about, you know, but fate and free will and determinism and all sorts of things like that. So yeah, it's a really good point.
But yeah, so there's something to be like, you know, horror isn't just like a set of negative emotions, right? It's an experience that we get sometimes when we discover something that we haven't learned, we don't have a place for, right? And that's what I meant by like the horror of philosophy, philosophical horror, is that, you know, you go deep enough and you something becomes a question which before had been a pleasant certainty. And that's actually what a lot of Lovecraft's stories use as a structure, where, you know, some dashing early 20th century man of science discovers that there is far more to this world and far darker powers behind it than he imagined, you know, in his laboratory or classroom.
Right. And even just talking a little bit about Scorpio and the nature of Scorpio, since of course this becomes eventually in this month the beginning of Scorpio season when the sun ingresses into Scorpio around October 23rd. You know, something I've been really focused on in trying to develop a more, I don't know, stable both conceptual and practical understanding of the signs is just the idea of the sign borrowing some of the significations from its domicile lord, and the domicile lord of that sign feeding significations to whatever planets are moving through it. Like, you know, if you have a planet transiting, like Jupiter transiting through a sign, it's like a person who's staying away from home, and they have to rely on the planet that rules that sign to feed it and to, you know, clothe it and give it a place to sleep and things like that. And the question becomes is like, what kind of significations does a sort of Scorpio type Mars feed to Jupiter as Jupiter is moving through that sign?
Right. Well, I mean, one way to think about it is that Jupiter will be in position to learn from whatever conflicts or frictions or exertions Mars provides. And that will change as Mars moves signs and aspects.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. It won't be consistent because Mars will shift. Mars moves much more quickly than Jupiter. So we're going to get different iterations of the Jupiter and Scorpio based on transiting Mars. That's something I've looked at when I've done my Saturn in the sign ebooks, is how the ruling planet of that cycle shifts the dynamic of what we're experiencing. So the Saturn in Sag cycle has had different flavors based on Jupiter being in Virgo versus Jupiter being in Libra, where it is now. And this last bit of Saturn in Sag has got a different tone again, because Jupiter will be in Scorpio for that last couple of months.
Right, which is right. And what's interesting, of course, is that when a planet is in its own domicile, it feeds itself significations, which is what's so interesting about Saturn into Capricorn and then Aquarius for 5 years, is that Saturn's just going to be doing Saturn and is going to need the opinions of no other planets.
Yes.
Right. The intensification of Saturn.
Well, and that's, it's almost like it's a more pure version, because the planet is not dealing with the influences of a ruler. It is the chairman of the board and the CEO too, rather than being the CEO and having a chairman overseeing you.
Right. There's no need for discussion.
Correct. It's like there's like an absolute, like a unilateral sort of approach, basically.
Right. Which is one of the reasons why Saturn has such a hard time in Cancer, right? Sad. The moon is feeding Saturn, which is trying to be stable, something different every 2.5 days when it's in Cancer.
Great point, Austin.
Right. A planet that thrives on stability being supported by a very unstable planet that fluctuates frequently.
Right. Like literally changing the agenda. Be like, actually, we're not building a house. We're building a pool.
Yeah.
No, let's not build it 2.5 days into construction. You know what? Let's open a business.
Let's make a cake. Let's see these people.
Yeah.
Right. And Saturn is asking for like a long-term 10-year projection for
right.
You know, the future of the company.
Yeah, and it's like the moon, revenues are down. We need to pick something. But anyway, and just speaking of, we should probably get back to this month, because there are a couple important things that I know we need to talk about. But later this season, we're going to have Mars in Scorpio with Jupiter, and that will be very interesting, because Jupiter, it'll be a very pure version of Jupiter in Scorpio.
Yes.
That doesn't come later into the season. We'll talk about that
next month. Yeah.
Right. And just related to that, before we move off of Jupiter in Scorpio, I mean, one thing that might be useful to think back on is I was always amused and surprised at how literal some of the Saturn and Scorpio manifestations are. As soon as it went in, like, there started being a lot of news articles in the very first part about, like, there was that controversy with, like, the head of the CIA where he got caught having an affair or something, and they were using, like, Gmail in order to, like, send secret messages to each other. And then all of a sudden there was this early panic about, you know, privacy and using programs like that. And that ended up being a precursor to like a year later, all of a sudden the Snowden controversy came out. And then there was everything about the NSA, you know, tapping everyone's communications and like how private were communications. And then suddenly all of these different companies came out in order to protect privacy and, you know, just issues about privacy and secrets. And a lot of different Scorpio themes came up with Saturn in Scorpio over that two and a half year period. And it's interesting here, we're going to have a return to that in some sense, but in a very different way with Jupiter moving through Scorpio over the next year. And I wonder if we won't see a return of similar themes, but I don't know if it's in a more positive way in some instances of the sort of glorification of some aspects of that, but perhaps in another way, like the expansion of some kind of theme surrounding that, which could be good or could be bad.
It could also be a proliferation of protective measures. You know, Jupiter likes to protect. It's one of Jupiter's things. And so on this note, Mercury moves into Scorpio on October 17th and then conjoins Jupiter right away. And so, you know, as far as kind of getting this Jupiter and Scorpio party started, Mercury's the first planet to conjoin Jupiter in its new sign. And so that'll be like the Jupiter in Scorpio significations should be pretty obvious pretty quick. And then the Sun will conjoin it a little bit less than a week later after it crosses into Scorpio. But we have a big new moon to talk about.
Yes.
Between those two. But we do get two planets conjoining Jupiter in its new sign. And so, you know, it's not like we're going to have to wait to see what Jupiter and Scorpio is about. It's going to be pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you gave the dates, the 18th with the Mercury and then the 26th with the Sun.
Right.
Yeah. So that conjunction with Mercury and Jupiter takes place at about one degree of Scorpio around October 18th. And the Sun takes place just a few days later. Here it is in the charts around the 25th and 26th. Well, especially the 26th.
Yep. Especially the 26th.
Yes.
All right. So it says this is like third quarter of October at this point.
Right. But between those, we have the new moon.
Yes.
So tightly conjunct Uranus.
I think it's 4 minutes away from a perfect opposition. It's absurd.
Yeah. So the Uranus so in Aries tight. Stuff, you know, that people might be dealing with late September with the Jupiter Uranus, it's kind of not done yet.
Yep. Yeah, you have both the Sun and the Moon taking up the position that Jupiter held during the final opposition.
Yes.
There it is. So 26:35 Libra.
Sorry, I think I said conjunct before, tightly opposite.
Right.
Yeah, we basically got 26:35 versus 26:31, 4 minutes away.
Wow. So that is
from a perfect
opposition. That is a really unstable, disruptive sort of influence to have on what is otherwise a kind of nice looking, you know, conjunction or new moon in Libra with the Venus itself in Libra at that point. And that sort of makes me think back to your statement earlier, Austin, about that Jupiter opposition with Uranus and what we learned from it over the past year, where Jupiter's trying to say, you know, let's have peace, and Uranus is saying, let's have disruption. So here again, we get one more little taste of that as we're finishing up the last bit of Uranus going through Aries with a really, really tight opposition of Uranus to the new moon at 26 Libra.
Yeah, it's a bit of a monkey wrench. But to be fair, if we look at what else is going on, there is a lot of how should we say, there are stabilizing factors. Mercury is still conjunct Jupiter pretty tightly. That's pretty smiley face. And we do have Venus in Libra, providing the Sun and Moon with, an ability to, adjust or compensate for shocks to the system. But that shock to the system is certainly that Sun Moon opposition to Uranus certainly testifies to that monkey wrench.
Yeah, I mean, it's also nice that once that new moon is completed and once that opposition to Uranus happens between the moon and Uranus, the moon is not going to aspect or complete any more aspects in that sign, at least zodiacally. But after that point, it's like pretty much clear sailing right to that conjunction with Jupiter and Scorpio. So there's this interesting transition where it's like you have the new moon, but then as soon as that's done, it's straight on to conjoining Jupiter and Scorpio.
Right. And of course the sun isn't going to sit there for a month like Jupiter.
Right. Right.
But you know, there is something about new moons, which, bakes some of that configuration into the DNA of the next several weeks.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so that's taking place. That new moon is on the 19th, and that's our second lunation of the month. So sort of back to the outline, I'm just looking through other things. Shortly after that, it looks like a couple of days or 3 days later, we get Mars ingressing into Libra on October 22nd. So the Venus and Libra party doesn't entirely come to a close, but it gets a new attendee of Mars catching up with Venus and moving into Venus's sign, which definitely changes the formula a little bit from the purely Venus action that was going on there to something more with Mars.
Yeah, well, so they're going to be co-present for the next, you know, several weeks after or a couple weeks. But, you know, the distance between them will continue to grow, right? Even though Mars is, you know, finally made it into the same sign as Venus again, Mars is falling further behind in that race every day. So there, we would be foolish not to interpret the co-presence but it's a widening, you know, it's a widening separating conjunction rather than an implying one. And so I think that's actually probably a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And in the elections, it's like we tried to get that other election in earlier in the month before Mars goes in. And this becomes one of the challenging things with continuing to do Venus elections this month, where it's like you can pull it off because at least it's not an applying, you know, conjunction with Mars. But it does create a bit of a different dynamic, especially in day charts, where Mars is going to be a bit more disruptive to what Venus is trying to do in Libra. Whereas in night charts, I think you can probably still get away with using Venus as a primary significator and Venus's more unifying significations winning out over Mars's more separating significations.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and also just with Venus, with the both of the planets being in Libra, Venus certainly has the superior potency. You know, Mars is visiting Venus's house, where Venus is in control, which also helps a lot. It's not, the Mars in Libra, I'd rather it stay at the end of Virgo. But it doesn't, I don't think it's going to spoil. I don't think it's going to spit in anybody's soup. I think it'll be fine.
Sure. All right. And we're getting towards the later part of October. Of course, a day later on October 23rd, we have the ingress of the Sun into Scorpio, beginning its 1 month journey through that sign. And very early on in that, it's met with the conjunction with Jupiter already at about 3 degrees of Scorpio on October 26th, it looks like. And Austin, you had a point about that, sort of like I mentioned in terms of Mercury earlier in the month, this starting a new cycle for the Sun and Jupiter.
Yeah, I mean, it's the beginning of Jupiter's synodic cycle, right? It's the Jupiter Kazemi we get once a year. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as it becomes visible again in November, and what's interesting is that, you know, Jupiter moves into Scorpio and we're barely going to be able to see it, and then we're not going to be able to see it in the sky. And so this is the sort of point of maximum invisibility. And then over the next couple of weeks, we'll begin to see Jupiter again rising in the morning just before the sun. And so from a synodic point of view, or from a phase point of view, this is the beginning of like a whole new year of Jupiter cycle, or a whole new 13-ish months. And so, you know, on an experiential level, if you're trying to, you know, get a bead on what there is to learn from Jupiter and Scorpio, or how you might benefit, or just kind of get acquainted with it. You know, there's in a sense, there's no better way than having the sun shining directly on it, right?
Right.
Absolutely. I think that really sets it, kind of creates a connection for each individual as to what that longer Jupiter and Scorpio cycle will be about. You're symbolically the sun, even just the joining of the two together, you know, whatever house or planets that might be activating for you, it's really the laying the foundation for how you're going to explore and grow or experience this Jupiter and Scorpio cycle.
Totally.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that had come up in some of our last discussions about like Saturn moving through certain signs and having like its last synodic conjunction with Saturn back when it was in Scorpio, and those being really sort of pivotal turning points in laying the foundation, or sometimes ending certain long periods in terms of those outer planet transits. So that seemed to work out pretty well in the past. So it's probably good to focus in on that here, as we've done, as pretty much the last major thing that happens towards the end of October at this point. So are there any other major things that we missed or that we skipped over? I mean, I'm just looking at the chart right now.
Just a little Venus square Pluto aspect around the 27th.
A little Venus square Pluto, yeah. 27th, 28th, or no, you're right, it is.
Yeah, it might be 20, just I guess it depends. I've got Eastern time zone, hang on, 11:20 p.m. Eastern on the 27th.
There we go. So right at 17, which, Libra.
Which is interesting because Venus will be in Libra, and I don't know about you guys, but sometimes when a planet in its own sign interacts with an outer planet, not to take away from the outer planet's influence and power, or dominance, I guess, but sometimes there can be some resource or something that is unlocked inside that planet. Like, I don't think this is as difficult necessarily as like Venus in Virgo square a Pluto, for instance, because Venus, she's in her own house, she's in her own sign, she's got access to things here. It's still a Venus square Pluto aspect, so there's still some of the themes around, you know, trust, truth, loyalty, and betrayal, particularly in partnerships. You know, is there the trust you thought that you had? Has there been a betrayal that you've only just discovered? But something, it's a little bit more of a rosy version of that, I guess. That's just my take. Do you guys consider like the strength of a planet in terms of how it interacts in an aspect?
Yeah, I agree with you both generally and specifically in this case.
Okay, so generally and specifically, tell us more, Austin.
Oh, no, I think the general principle you're delineating, that a planet, when it's powerfully positioned in terms of essential dignity, is able to defend its significations and its priorities from contrary influences. You know, it's just like if... just to use a crude metaphor, like if you were going to go up and steal somebody's wallet, if it was like a 9-foot man with robot chainsaw arms wearing medieval armor, let's say this is Mars, right? That would be a harder person to steal from than a 5-year-old child.
Sure.
Right. And that the more powerful, and, you know, whatever, and, you know, the planets are trying to do, they're always trying to do the same thing, right? Venus is always trying to do Venus things. And Venus has pretty much maximum resources available to do Venus things, you know, to bring harmony where there is strife, to, you know, to bring people together when they want to separate, et cetera, et cetera. Like, Pluto definitely can, like, undermine a little bit here. There might be, like, an undermining of a deal or an agreement, but Venus has a tremendous ability to adjust and adapt to whatever the challenge to the balanced, just, fair relating is.
Yeah, as if she's got access to better resources or that her specific talents are more fully available to her right now, so that whatever Pluto is throwing at her, she can meet or respond to, she can deal with it fairly deftly.
Yeah, and I would also just add that, like, you know, this is a couple days.
It's not a huge game changer.
We did harder stuff in October than this.
Yeah.
But it might feel weird for, you know, a day or two.
For a beat.
A lot of times that's how I experience these. I'm like, I don't know.
Well, you know, and I guess
And then it passes.
And it probably depends on whether the Pluto transit itself is triggering something in your chart.
Right. If Pluto is on your descendant
at
the time that this happens, it'll probably be more than just like
a passing thing,
you know, for a few days, you know, might bring up something significant.
I like that general distinction though, that you're raising there, which is the difference between like Venus herself in the, like, let's say, inferior position of being manipulated or controlled by Pluto versus what happens when Venus is the one in the superior or the more dominant role. And that theme, you know, she's the one playing the manipulator or the one that's in control of the situation, maybe as part of the difference.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. She's not completely at the mercy of whatever Pluto might be stirring up.
Right. A planet in its own domicile is in many ways defined, as we got to earlier, right, by not having to answer to any other planet.
Right. All right. Well, and that's a really interesting and great, perhaps, point to leave on, with Venus right there in the middle of Libra at the close of the month. So maybe it's time to wind this down. Do you guys have any other parting things? Is there anything we forgot to touch on that we want to do before we wrap up today?
I like October. I have good feelings about October. I haven't liked the last couple months.
Even with all the... Saturn squares, Austin.
Oh yeah, those are great.
I've been loving those. The guy who's got Mars Saturn and living on his Mars Saturn lines.
Yeah. No, I've got enough of that. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to Jupiter and Scorpio. I think it's going to be the idea of Jupiter moving into a fixed sign, some sort of stabilization or it's just an anchoring vibration coming through.
Well, at the very least.
At the very least, it's not opposite Uranus anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have water planets, it's going to feel good.
Yeah. And this is the start also of what the next year is going to look like and what that period is going to look like of not just Jupiter in Scorpio, but like really soon after this, we're going to get Saturn in Capricorn. So there's a huge shift going on here of outer planets moving into, feminine signs. And that's a lot different.
It's huge, Chris. Yeah. I had meant to say this earlier. Jupiter going into Scorpio is the first of really what will ultimately be three shifts of planets moving out of the yang, air, fire signs into the more feminine earth and water signs. Jupiter in Scorpio in October, Saturn in Cap in December, and then if we just stretch it out, we will have Uranus dip into Taurus for a few months next year as well. I'm not necessarily saying that's going to be great, and I know we'll talk about it more, but just from that shift of the yangy air, fire into earth and water, it's quite substantial.
Is that happening for you too, Austin?
Kelly's frozen and we're not.
Did time freeze or is it just us? Are we like stuck?
It's a Saved by the Bell right. moment. Until Kelly unfreezes, I wanted to add another thing to what she was saying. Because I think that it's a very real thing, is that if we look at Chinese years, our next Chinese year is of the earth element, whereas we're doing a fire one this year. So we're going to be moving to a more yin elemental flavor in that system as well.
We lost Kelly. All right. Well, that's a good natural way then to close down the show. So thanks to, hopefully we got her recording. So thanks.
We miss you, Kelly.
We miss Kelly. Kelly, I hope you're okay wherever you are right now. And I'm going to talk to you guys again in a few weeks when we do meet again to do the forecast for November. So thanks for joining me, Austin.
Yeah, that was great.
That was a good episode. And thanks to our audience who joined us for the live recording. I really appreciate it. And I hope to see many of you again next month when we do this again with a live episode for patrons. And thanks everyone else who's listening to the show on the podcast website itself. So always remember to leave a comment in the comment section of the podcast episode for other observations you've had or other things that you were interested in terms of the transits of next month. If you're listening to us through iTunes, then please go ahead and give us a good rating on iTunes, since that'll help other people to find the show. And I think that's about it. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.